Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick. I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, April 21st, 2024.
From Advances, in the November 2023 issue of Scientific American, in the Department of Climate Change, zeroing in, supercomputer network could predict climate change effects down to the neighborhood. Scientists have used computer models to predict global warming's implications for more than five decades. As climate change intensifies, these increasingly precise models require more and more computing power. For a decade, the best simulations have been able to predict climate change effects down to a 25 square kilometer area. Now, a new modeling project could tighten the resolution to 1 kilometer, helping policymakers and city planners spot the neighborhoods or even individual buildings most vulnerable to extreme weather events. Climate science has always had a computing problem, says Bjorn Stevens, director of Germany's Max Planck Institute for Meteorology. Recent technological advances, such as shrinking transistors, however, have made computers far more capable, Stevens says. He and a group of climatologists and scientists from other disciplines are developing a network of global supercomputing centers called Earth Visualization Engines, or EVE, which they hope to complete within the decade. These centers would work together by running climate models, interpreted by machine learning algorithms, on supercomputers to predict climatic shifts and severe weather events locally. This international push, which organizers have called the CERN, CERN of climate science, could help municipalities mitigate disasters, say supporters who planned to present the proposal at the 28th United Nations Climate Change Conference last November. Higher resolution modeling could show how wind shear affects certain buildings, where floodwaters might go, or what areas are most vulnerable to damage. These details could inform measures taken before dangerous events, such as heat waves, hurricanes, or droughts, helping officials determine when and where to save water, set up cooling centers, or shore up infrastructure. Such fine-grained modeling may be enabled by a recent technological advance, a superchip called Grace Hopper, named after the pioneering computer scientist and developed by computer technology company NVIDIA. 10 years in the making, it could be used to process models as many as 6 times faster than other superchips while using less energy, says Dion Harris, NVIDIA's head of Accelerated Data Center Project Marketing. As EVE moves forward, that is the Earth Visualization Engines, Stevens and other planners envision making the data and models publicly available. Doing so, especially in developing countries hit hardest by the climate crisis, should be prioritized before rolling out new and expensive computing technologies, says Gavin Schmidt of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, who is not involved with EVE. There is a large amount of useful climate information that isn't accessible, Schmidt says. Climate modelers are trying to make the best of the information, get it out there, and help people make better decisions for adaptation. And this article was posted by Susan Kosher. Also in the November 2023 issue of Scientific American, in the Department of Medicine, catching it early, scientists develop wearable breast cancer scanner. If breast cancer is caught early, its survival rate is nearly 100%. If not, that rate can quickly drop to roughly 25%. Women older than 50 in the U.S. are advised to get mammograms every 2 years, but the most aggressive tumors often arise and are diagnosed between screenings. These interval cancers account for around a quarter of all breast cancer cases, and by the time you're diagnosed, it may be too late, says Kannan Dagdaviran, a materials engineer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So Dagdaviran and her team have developed a wearable ultrasound scanner that could be used at home to detect breast tumors earlier, particularly in high-risk people. Frequent screening is the key for survival, she says. Conventional and bulky ultrasound scanning machines use piezoelectric materials, which convert electrical signals into movement to send out sound waves that penetrate the body. Denser tissue reflects more sound, signaling the presence of a tumor. Scientist Dr. Viren says she and her team miniaturized a scanner using a new type of piezoelectric material that performs better and requires less power. You get better penetration of deep tissue using lower voltage, she says. The researchers incorporated the scanner into a flexible, honeycombed 3D printed patch that can be fixed into a bra. The wearer moves the scanner among six different positions on the breast, where it snaps into place with magnets, allowing reproducible scanning of the whole breast. The scanner, which could be used once a week or month, was recently described in the journal Science Advances. The device achieves resolution comparable to ultrasound scanners commonly used in medical centers, but it does not have to be operated by a trained technician. If you have a wearable solution that individuals can use at their pleasure, you can capture a lot more data, says engineer Ruzbe Jafari of Texas A&M University, who was not involved in the work. That additional data can help doctors track a cancer's development and a treatment's efficacy. Dogdaviren was inspired to develop the device when her aunt passed away from breast cancer at the age of 49, despite regular screening. Just to comfort her, I sketched an ultrasound bra by her bedside, she says. It was a dream on a piece of paper, but now it's in my hands. She and her colleagues believe the technology could have a profound effect. With a very humble calculation, we found that this has the potential to save 12 million lives per year globally, she says. Clinical trials are underway in a bid for approval from the Food and Drug Administration. The device must still be connected to a conventional ultrasound machine to view the scans, but the team is working on a phone-sized device to analyze and transmit the data. Depending on cost, the notion of equity could also be addressed because you no longer need to pay for hospital settings, physicians, nurses, and so on, Jafari says. This device could be used in ambulatory settings, remote areas, and underserved communities. And again, this new scanner could help detect aggressive breast tumors early on, and the survival rate would be nearly 100%. This article is written by Simon Macken. From the Department of Ecology, bombshell. Turtle shells record ecosystems' nuclear history. The invention of nuclear weapons has shaped not only our planet's political history and systems, but its natural history as well. A study in the journal PNAS Nexus shows how scientists are examining the latter in a surprising place, the shells of turtles that lived near nuclear production and testing sites. The researchers detected traces of uranium in the shells of four turtles, including one sea turtle and one tortoise, that lived near such sites before being collected as natural history specimens between the 1950s and the 1980s. Using a mass spectrometer, a device that detects the material's chemical makeup, the scientists matched the signatures of uranium isotopes in the shells to the distinct signatures produced by nuclear production and detonation. Isotopes are varieties of an element that contain different numbers of neurons in their nuclei. In one of the specimens, they tracked the animal's uranium uptake over time by tracing isotope levels in individual concentric layers that form in shells like tree rings. Nuclear weapons are powered by the fission or splitting of uranium or other radioactive elements. The creation and detonation of such weapons shed these elements into the environment, where they are taken up into the local ecosystem. The shells that the team analyzed weren't technically radioactive because they contained such small amounts of uranium, around one part per billion, says study co-author Siler Conrad, an earth scientist at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. The turtles had survived their nuclear exposure, and their health probably wasn't affected, Conrad says. Finding uranium in turtle shells is not necessarily surprising in itself. The element occurs naturally in soil, rock, and water. But Conrad and his colleagues were amazed that they could detect such tiny amounts of it and could match the isotope signature to a site's known nuclear history. Conrad hopes the study's new technique, which his team is adapting for use with plutonium, can help scientists determine where and when nuclear activity occurred, as well as how radioactive materials move from soil and water into plants and animals. He also thinks it could be used to trace exposure to nuclear fuel, in addition to weapons. For Laura Martin, an environmental historian at Williams College, the study is a reminder of the scars left by the U.S., its nuclear program, and not just in Japan, where the U.S. deployed nuclear bombs as weapons in World War II. Production and experimental detonations also sent radiation and other pollution into American neighborhoods and ecosystems, particularly in the West and often on or near indigenous lands, as well as in the Marshall Islands. This paper points us to how nuclear colonialism is not just a human history, Martin says. It has affected and continues to impact the whole biosphere. This article written by Megan Bartles. And some quick hits from science news around the world. In Antarctica, research stations in Antarctica have polluted surrounding ocean areas with heavy metals, fuel components, and carcinogenic compounds, a new study shows. The contamination has accumulated because of poor waste management over decades. In French Polynesia, thought to reproduce only at night, corals in reefs near French Polynesia were spotted doing the deed in broad daylight. It's unclear why, but researchers suggest this might help the species thrive in warming waters. In Germany, paleontologists in Bavaria unearthed the first complete fossil of a 150-million-year-old turtle. It had stubby limbs and a flattened carapace, suggesting that, unlike modern sea turtles, this ancient reptile lived along shallow coastlines. From Portugal, archaeologists found 3,000-year-old mummified bees in rocks off Portugal's southwestern coast. Likely entombed by a flash freeze or flood, the insects were remarkably well-preserved in bulb-shaped cocoons. It's the first such ancient nest to be found with intact mummified specimens. From the UK, London's mayor, Sadiq Khan, successfully expanded the city's ultra-low emission zone to include all boroughs. The stricter standards on car exhausts have been politically divisive, but have led to a 26% reduction in harmful pollution emissions. And from the U.S., a Montana judge ruled that children have a constitutional right to a clean and healthy environment. This is a major victory for 16 young Montanans who sued their state, as well as for the growing movement for legal protection from damage related to climate change. These quick hits appear in the November 2023 issue of Scientific American and are written by Timmy Broderick. And now to The Science of Health, a monthly column written by Lydia Denworth in the Scientific American. This is from the September 2023 issue. Hearing aids may lower risk of dementia. Age-related hearing loss is linked to mental and physical problems. A friend recently noticed that she couldn't always hear her phone ringing or family members calling from another room. A hearing test revealed mild loss in high frequencies, which was possibly age-related. She is in her early 60s, and some difficulty with these frequencies often comes with advancing years. She didn't need hearing aids yet, but she says she'll monitor the situation and get them if the time comes. She was glad she asked for the test. Not many people do, nor do most doctors offer. It's not routine to screen adults for hearing loss, even though about 14% of Americans older than 12 have trouble hearing. The prevalence increases dramatically with age, to half or more of those over 70. Hearing loss often comes on so gradually that many don't notice. Others ignore it. Only an estimated 15 to 25% of adults who would benefit from hearing aids use them, and use is lowest among people who have less access to health care. Yet recent research has revealed that even mild or moderate hearing loss in older adults is associated with accelerated cognitive decline. People with hearing loss are more likely to develop dementia, and the likelihood increases with the severity of the loss. In 2020, a Lancet Commission on Dementia identified hearing loss as the leading modifiable midlife risk factor for later development of the disease. In July of last year, at the annual meeting of the Alzheimer's Association, Frank Lin, an otolaryngologist and director of the Cochlear Center for Hearing and Public Health at Johns Hopkins University, presented results from a first-of-its-kind randomized clinical trial of 977 adults between the ages of 70 and 84 with untreated hearing loss. One group received best practice hearing care, including aids, and another group took part in a program about successful aging. 3 years later, hearing aids did not make much difference to the healthiest participants, but those who were at the higher risk for dementia because of age and underlying health conditions saw a 48% reduction in cognitive change if they got hearing aids. When hearing loss is untreated, the brain's organization changes, says auditory neuroscientist Anu Sharma of the University of Colorado Boulder. In adults with mild hearing loss, studies show a decrease in gray matter. Sharma found early signs that vision and touch areas of the brain encroach on and repurpose underused hearing areas. Adults with hearing loss also show more activity in working memory areas. They need to make extra efforts just to listen, Sharma says, which may deplete cognitive reserves. Hearing loss is also associated with more falls, higher healthcare costs, and increased loneliness and social isolation. Hearing is fundamental to healthy aging, says Nicholas Reed, an audiologist and epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins, who worked with Lin on the cognitive decline study. These consequences of hearing loss contributed to the Food and Drug Administration's decision last year, 2022, to create a category of over-the-counter hearing aids. Traditional aids dispensed by audiologists average $4,700 a pair and are not covered by Medicare or most private insurance. Most of the new OTC devices, over-the-counter, cost between $500 and $1,900. But quality varies a lot in this range. The high end includes customizable devices. Less expensive aids are preset with limited options, a one-size-fits-all approach that doesn't really fit all. Most users of over-the-counter devices still benefit from help getting set up and then troubleshooting devices. But setup help doesn't have to come from audiologists. In Baltimore, the Johns Hopkins Cochlear Center created a successful program of peer mentoring for older, low-income adults with hearing loss. It's too soon to assess whether the new devices will close the yawning gap between the large need for hearing aids and the smaller demand for them. In one survey, only about half of non-users said they would use hearing aids, even if they were free. It may help that popular consumer-oriented brands, such as Hewlett-Packard and Jabra, have jumped into the field. The key to getting around stigma will be the ubiquity of wanting to hear well and the sense that everyone is doing it. Lynn says, if wireless earbuds also became hearing aids, that changes the whole perspective of what it means to use hearing technology. Next, the science of health, from the November 2023 issue of Scientific American. Health span can matter more than lifespan. The Biology of Aging Holds Clues to Extending Your Healthy Years by Lydia Denworth. Over the past century, the average life expectancy in developed countries has increased by 30 years, from roughly age 50 to age 80. Vaccines, sanitation, antibiotics, and other advances allow many more people to survive infectious diseases that used to kill them during childhood. In the U.S., though, the span dropped nearly 3 years during the COVID pandemic, a testament to the power of infections to shorten lives. Longer lifespans overall have been a public health success, but they have also created a new and important gap. Health spans, usually defined as the period of life free of chronic disease or disability, do not always match longevity. In this, my 12th year of caring for a relative with Alzheimer's disease, I know this fact well. By one calculation, based on the World Health Organization's Healthy Life Expectancy Indicator, an American who expects to live to 79 might first face serious disease at 63. That could mean 15 years, 20% of life, lived in sickness. Indeed, aging is the biggest risk factor for cancer, heart disease, and dementia. One reason for this gap is that, for decades, biomedical research and clinical practice have focused on treating individual diseases, which can extend lives, but not necessarily health span. During the past 10 years, medicine has started to take a different approach based on the biology of aging, a field called geroscience. We are now saying our focus should be on extending healthy life rather than just length of life, and slowing aging is the tool to do it, says Jay Olshansky, a longevity expert at the University of Illinois at Chicago. There are molecular and cellular processes in all our tissues and organs that determine both life span and health span. These pillars of aging include DNA damage, the aging or senescence of individual cells, inflammation, and stress responses. Natural variations in these factors are mostly the result of environmental differences. Genes also play a role, accounting for about 25% of the variability, more in extreme cases. Very long-lived smokers probably won the genetic lottery. The upshot is that some people age faster than others, and with biological aging comes susceptibility to disease and disability. How do you assess biological age? Molecular markers such as chemical modifications to DNA are one way, says computational biologist Morgan Levine of Altos Labs in San Diego. Do your cells have a pattern of chemical tags, like someone who is 20 or 30 or 40, she asks. Geroscientists have yet to deliver a pill or treatment that can slow or reverse what the pillars of aging do. But they are excited about some possibilities. For example, senolytic drugs target senescent cells, which no longer divide but linger in the body instead of being cleared by the immune system. Research has shown that these zombie cells secrete proteins that interfere with other cells' health. The zombies have been linked to osteoarthritis, cancer, and dementia. For a 2015 study, researchers used senolytics to remove senescent cells in mice and delayed, prevented, or alleviated multiple disorders. Clinical trials are underway in people, but are years from completion, so researchers are cautious. They also note that few popular wellness claims about prolonging your youth are grounded in evidence. For now, one way to extend health span is through unsurprising preventative maintenance. Experts recommend checkups, staying on top of cholesterol levels and blood pressure, and following guidelines, such as those from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, for body fat percentage, lean body mass, and bone density. Know where you are, so if something needs to be tweaked, you can take steps to do that, says Matt Kaberline, founding director of the University of Washington Healthy Aging and Longevity Research Institute, and now chief executive officer of Optispan, a health tech company. Those steps are also familiar. Common sense nutrition, sleep, exercise, and social connection are the four main factors. The reason those things work is because they modulate the biology of aging, Kaeberlein says. For instance, regular low or moderate intensity exercise helps to prevent cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes. How much extra health can these steps get us? 10 years is probably pretty realistic, Kaeberlein says. The author of The Science of Health, Lydia Denworth, is an award-winning science journalist and contributing editor for Scientific American. She is author of the book Friendship, published by W.W. Norton in 2020. Next, from the study of astronomy, an article entitled Star Child, Baby Galaxy Could Provide a Glimpse into the Early Universe. A galaxy that is just emerging from hiding may be one of the youngest ever discovered, offering a potential portal to the secrets of the early universe. Aptly named Peekaboo, the galaxy moved from behind a bright star, from our perspective, only within the past 50 to 100 years. But it's not just the galaxy's relatively recent appearances that has astronomers excited. In results published in Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, scientists report that Peekaboo appears to have a significant lack of old stars. The new measurements suggest the dwarf galaxy may have formed billions of years after the Big Bang, much later than other galaxies close to ours. Pretty much every galaxy in the nearby universe has very, very old stars dating back to shortly after the Big Bang, says Gagandeep Anand, an astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute and co-author of the new study. As stars age, they create heavier elements, including metals. Peekaboo is one of just three comparatively nearby galaxies that astronomers have found to be extremely metal poor, and at 22 million light years away, it's by far the closest, making it favorable for further study. Astronomers first spotted a hint of the Peekaboo galaxy in 2001 during an all-sky survey, but the glare of a closer star largely obscured it from additional scrutiny. High-quality images taken by the Hubble Space Telescope in 2020 confirmed the partially hidden object to be a dwarf galaxy, and later optical observations revealed a lack of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium, suggesting that Peekaboo's conditions could mimic those of galaxies in the early universe. Researchers don't yet know whether Peekaboo's metal-poor state definitively indicates its age. There are other possibilities to consider as well, says Rutgers University astrophysicist Kristen McQuinn, who was not involved in the new study. One alternative possibility, she suggests, is that Peekaboo, as a dwarf galaxy, has a relatively weak gravitational pull that allowed its heavy metals to be expelled by galactic winds. Current measurements don't suggest that the galaxy has any stars older than 2 billion or 3 billion years, but Anand notes that follow-up observations, perhaps with the ultra-powerful James Webb Space Telescope, would allow the researchers to search for fainter stars as old as 13 billion years. If found, such stars would call Peekaboo's youth into question. But if the Peekaboo galaxy is as young as the researchers think it could be, it would be one of the best laboratories available to study the way the universe was closer to the Big Bang. Researchers could come away with a better understanding of the physics of gas cooling and star formation in an environment like the early universe, McQuinn says. And this article was written by Allison Gasparini. The Sun is not the only celestial body in the news. From the February 10, 2024 issue of Science News, now streaming on Mars, future red planet explorers will need to connect with each other and us. Written by Payal Dhar. When astronauts land on Mars a couple of decades from now, perhaps they'll need to find a way to communicate with each other, with equipment on and around the planet, and with mission control back on Earth. Despite living so far from home, they'll no doubt want to connect with loved ones, keep their playlists up to date, or stream the latest episodes of their favorite shows. But setting up a Wi-Fi connection to Earth's internet won't be an option. Earth is simply too far away, around 50 million to 400 million kilometers, depending on where the planets are in their orbits. Spacefarers will need another strategy. Establishing a good communications infrastructure is essential for human missions to Mars, says Claire Parfit, a systems engineer with the European Space Agency, or ESA, who is based in the Netherlands. At the moment, we are in the early stages of working out what that means. Researchers are testing ways to upgrade existing networks, along with some far-out alternatives, for example. NASA's Psyche mission, which lifted off in October with the job of exploring an asteroid between Mars and Jupiter, will also test interplanetary communication using lasers. Lasers could carry far more data than the radio waves that have been used from the earliest days of space travel. No known strategies can get rid of the time lag in communications between Earth and Mars. A message moving at the speed of light takes anywhere between 4 and 24 minutes for a one-way trip. In other words, a quick ping to mission control is out of the question, not to mention a WhatsApp call home. There's also the issue of solar conjunction, says Parfit, when the sun comes between Earth and Mars. This happens for a couple of weeks every 2 years or so, cutting off communications between the planets. The last one took place in November 2023. But new approaches could open possibilities that make communications on Mars more akin to what we experience here on Earth. At least one research team has wondered, what if Mars had its own internet? How communication works today. Several space agencies have landers, rovers, and satellites already at Mars that have to communicate with Earth. Consider NASA's Perseverance rover. It sends and receives two kinds of information. One is command and telemetry, where operators on Earth send instructions, receive information, and make decisions on what to do next. Percy typically receives over 1,000 commands from Earth every day. The second is the science data, pictures of Martian rocks, for example, that Percy collects. Percy, by the way, is the nickname for Perseverance. The helicopter Ingenuity also regularly pings the rover, which serves as a base station to relay data and commands between Ingenuity and Earth. Orbiters circling the planet, including NASA's Mars Odyssey and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, or MRO, and the European Space Agency's Trace Gas Orbiter, or TGO, similarly send science data back home. A lot of the communication with Mars is routed through the Mars Relay Network in what NASA describes as a tightly choreographed dance. This network of five orbiters around Mars, MRO, TGO, MAVEN, Mars Odyssey, and Mars Express, transmits information via antennas pointed toward Earth. A rover that needs to send its latest observations back to Earth first passes the data along to one of the orbiters using ultra-high frequency radio transmissions. If that orbiter doesn't have a line of sight to Earth, it can hold on to the information until it does. The data are then relayed toward Earth, where powerful radio antennas distributed across the globe are always listening for pings from deep space. Once a human crew lands on Mars, this system will not be good enough. Vincent Chan, a researcher in fiber optic and satellite communications at MIT, doesn't foresee local, on-the-ground communication as a challenge. A Martian crew can interact using radio frequency and existing wireless technologies, he says. Two mini cell towers would be enough when the astronauts are close together, and a relay of some kind could be used when the astronauts are far enough apart that messages have to be sent over the horizon. People living in remote regions of Earth communicate in a similar way all the time. Those services are already in play, Chan says, and very economical. A big antenna on the crew's landing vehicle, pointed toward Earth, would probably be the very first infrastructure Martian explorers would set up, Chan says, but then things could get more challenging. When that ground-based antenna doesn't have a direct line of sight, astronauts could use orbital relays, akin to the Mars Relay Network, to communicate with Earth. Several orbiters would have to be available for round-the-clock coverage, and they'd need to be optimized for heavy data transfer. ESA is currently looking at making today's relay network more robust. It is in the early stages of considering a concept called the Mars Communication and Navigation Infrastructure, or MARCONI. If it moves forward, the project will develop a set of communication and navigation-related payloads that could piggyback on any mission headed to Mars. Once deployed into orbit, these payloads would act as nodes to provide radio communication on and with Mars, Parfit explains. They could then stick around for use on future missions. The more mass you land, the more expensive it is, so you wouldn't necessarily want to land massive communication systems on Mars every time. Though traditional radio frequencies would suffice for low data rates, using a laser link could carry 10 to 100 times as much data in the same time frame. Because of the higher frequencies of optical waves, hundreds of thousands of times those of radio waves, much more information can be packed in. Thus, this type of optical signal is just where space communication may be headed. The Psyche spacecraft, launched last October 2023, will test the feasibility of long-distance laser communications as it heads toward Psyche, the metal-rich asteroid it's going to explore. The spacecraft carries NASA's Deep Space Optical Communications, or DSOC, technology. Using lasers for space communication isn't new, but they have never been tested from distances farther than the Moon. In mid-November, Psyche beamed data to Earth from a distance of 16 million kilometers, 40 times farther than the Moon. In December, it sent a video of a cat named Taters from 31 million kilometers away. The European Space Agency is also exploring long-distance optical communications. One program called SCY Light, short for Secure and Laser Communication Technology, and pronounced Skylight, is supporting the research and development of optical and quantum technologies for secure and fast data communication from space. Despite the benefits, optical communication requires ultra-precision in aiming the signal. Unlike radio communications, optical signals are sent in a narrow beam that has to point exactly at the receiver. What's more, cloud cover and atmospheric effects also interfere with lasers. Any shift toward optical communications would mean some upgrades to the existing radio antennas that listen for messages from deep space, called the Deep Space Network, or new infrastructure. Though it's closer than Mars, the Moon offers learning opportunities for future connectivity. As part of the Artemis program, which aims to return humans to the Moon, NASA has contracted private companies to set up a lunar 4G network for telecommunications. Such networks are based on radio waves and would include installing antennas and base stations that can withstand the harsh lunar landscape. An ESA program called Moonlight invites private space companies to set up a constellation of communication satellites around the Moon, including for regions that don't have direct visibility to Earth. The first phase of the program includes the launch of the Lunar Pathfinder Orbiter, currently planned for 2026. Everything that is being done for the Moon, it's got the objective of taking humans and missions to Mars, says Tomas Navarro, who is based in London and is a future projects engineer with ESA. Those Martian explorers, not to mention future inhabitants, will no doubt want to do more than send messages back and forth. They'll want a setup akin to Earth's internet,
which we use for everything from sharing photos to accessing massive databases. In June 2023, Tobias Pfanzelter and David Bernbach of Technische Universität Berlin proposed that a fleet of satellites orbiting Mars could provide the Red Planet with its own offshoot internet. Most of us here on Earth access the internet through our phones using radio frequencies radiation and on either wireless 4G or 5G networks or through Wi-Fi routers. These connections are linked via fiber optic cables around the world. The proposed Mars network would instead be similar to Starlink, a constellation of satellites in low Earth orbit operated by SpaceX. On Earth, broadband, internet, and mobile phone coverage via satellite is expensive, but on Mars, such a system might be cheaper and easier to build than an expansive and robust network on the ground. Pfanzelter and Bernbach are both experts in cloud computing, the delivery of computing services over the internet. For their proposed Martian internet, they extrapolated concepts from edge computing, in which information is processed close to where it is collected. Michael Clegg, a general manager at the technology company Supermicro, based in San Jose, California, has explained edge computing using the analogy of a popular pizza restaurant that opens smaller branches in more neighborhoods, since a pie baked at the main location would get cold on its way to a distant customer. Edge computing generally relies on base stations on the ground to store and relay the data, but low Earth orbit satellites are now being seen as an alternative. Pfanzelter and Bernbach concluded that a constellation of 81 low orbit satellites around Mars would be good enough for planet-wide coverage. They would provide a local communications system that would be an extension of Earth's internet. Consider an astronaut on Mars trying to catch up on a Netflix show. If you were to stream it from Earth, you would have to first wait 10, 15, or even 40 minutes, Pfanzelter says. And that's just to connect. It would be a frustrating stop-and-start affair. And if another astronaut on Mars wanted to watch the same movie, they have to go through the same process all over again. Instead, a cloud data storage system on Mars could make movies easy to access. You could just have the same experience that you have on Earth because all your data is locally copied, he says. Meanwhile, other uploads and downloads to and from Earth, such as science data, could continue in the background. Putting internet satellites into orbit around Mars would also be economical because it wouldn't require landing infrastructure on the surface. Landing equipment can make up a big chunk of a mission's budget. It would be much cheaper to just send a bunch of networking satellites to Mars and just keep them in orbit, says Pfanzelter. It's similar to a scaled-up version of the Marconi concept and could use radio or optical waves, depending on the state of those technologies. Even if arrival on Mars is decades away, Parfit says, it's not too soon to start planning. Live video chatting between planets is out of the realm of scientific possibility. Unless there is a major upheaval in the laws of physics, messages won't ever be able to travel faster than the speed of light. It's not a problem to be solved, it's just a problem. But other limitations can be overcome. Tackling those challenges may not only benefit future astronauts on Mars, but may also help get them there sooner. When you put in an infrastructure like that, Parfit says, you see many, many more missions being proposed. The author of this article, Payal Dhar, is a freelance journalist and author based in Bangalore, India. And this article appears in the February 10th, 2024 issue of Science News. These animals can bend the mind. At least one of their compounds is psychedelic, while others remain mysterious. The article is featured in the May 6th, May 20, 2023 issue of Science News. The adage, all attention is good attention, may be true for marketers, not so for the Sonoran Desert Toad. Last fall, the U.S. National Park Service sent out a message on Facebook asking visitors to refrain from licking the toad, technically Incilius olivarius, but commonly called Bufo olivarius. That message came months after a New York Times article covered the booming interest in the psychedelic compound that the toad excretes from its skin, along with the poaching, over-harvesting, and illegal trafficking that have accompanied that interest. People don't typically lick the toads to get high, says Robert Villa, a community outreach specialist at the University of Arizona's Desert Laboratory on Tumamoc Hill. The secretions the toads produce are toxic when ingested. They work orally through the mucous membranes and cause really dangerous side effects like cardiac arrest, Villa says. Instead, for decades, people have been collecting these secretions, then drying and smoking them. When inhaled, a compound within 5-MeO-DMT can cause auditory and visual hallucinations. It's a very powerful psychedelic, sometimes called the God molecule, says pharmacologist and chemist David Nichols of Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. The drug's growing popularity could be bad news for toad populations. If you relocate it outside of its home territory, Villa says, which often happens when people collect a toad for its secretions, it gets lost and its chances for survival go way down. What's more, collecting large numbers of toads increases the risk of disease transmission, like chytrid fungus, between toads. We at Science News heard the PSA loud and clear, just leave this toad alone. But we couldn't help but wonder, what other amazing animals may have psychedelic potential? On the following pages, freelance writer Deborah Balthazar takes us on a tour by land and sea of some of the world's mind-altering fauna. The first animal featured is the Sonoran Desert toad. Its habitat is the Sonoran Desert in the southwestern United States and northern Mexico. All toads secrete toxins from their skins. These secretions, whose specific compounds vary from species to species, probably evolved as a way to keep a toad's body moist. Over time, the compounds, which can also act on the brain and affect heart muscle when ingested, came to aid in self-defense. But the Sonoran Desert toad, also known as the Colorado River toad, appears to have taken evolution one step further. The toad, one of the largest in North America, secretes an enzyme that converts bufotenine, a compound also made by other toads, into 5-MeO-DMT, a powerful hallucinogen related to the psychedelic drug DMT. A frightened Sonoran Desert toad gushes its toxic mix, which includes 5-MeO-DMT, from its parotoid glands, located behind each eye, and from glands on its legs. It's a way to say, please don't eat me, I don't taste good. When swallowed in large quantities by a potential predator, the toxins can cause coma, cardiac arrest, and even death. Scientists aren't yet sure why the Sonoran Desert toad produces 5-MeO-DMT, and why it is the only toad known to make it. There's a lot of mystery, Villa says. The second mind-bending animal profiled is the giant monkey frog. Its habitat is the Amazon basin in South America. And its Latin name is Phylomedusa bicolor. There's no scientific consensus on whether Combo, the name for the toxic secretion produced by the giant monkey frog, should be considered a psychedelic. The term psychedelic comes from Greek, meaning mind manifesting, Nichols says. You can imagine it's enhancing the properties of your mind rather than just intoxicating you. Other compounds, such as stimulants and depressants, modify the activity of the brain, but they don't leave users with the kind of new insights and memorable experiences that come with psychedelics. Welton Monteiro, a tropical medicine researcher at the Universidad do Estado do Amazonas in Manaus, Brazil, points to a 2020 study in Scientific Reports as an example of why the classification has been unclear. In the small study,
Nearly half of participants who reported using Combo said they had a spiritual experience, and some experiences came with what resembled the afterglow often associated with hallucinogens. But Combo doesn't activate the 5-HT2A receptor, a protein that senses the chemical messenger serotonin, while classic psychedelics do. Among indigenous populations in the southwestern Amazon, the frog's skin secretions have been used for centuries as a stimulant in shamanistic rituals. According to Villa, the secretions are usually applied on small superficial burns on the body to increase the stamina of hunters. In predators attempting to gobble the frog, Combo might cause regurgitation, seizures, and a change in heart function. Researchers are still trying to decipher the specific compounds that explain these effects, but they do know that species of Phylomedusa collectively produce over 200 short protein fragments that can influence body function. Some might be promising for future medicines. The third mind bender profiled is the California harvester ant. The venom of the California harvester ant is made up of enzymes that aren't known to cause hallucinations on their own, but the indigenous peoples of Central California once ate them during rituals, including vision quests. Ethnographic reports suggest people would swallow hundreds of live ants in balls of eagle down feathers. No doubt the people were stung, likely on the insides. Justin Schmidt, an entomologist at the Southwestern Biological Institute and University of Arizona in Tucson, who died in February, said the pain of being stung by so many ants, along with extreme cold, fasting, and in some cases sleep deprivation, triggered hallucinations that connected the people with spiritual guides. A harvester's ant's sting is nothing like a bee sting, Schmidt wrote in The Sting of the Wild. The pain is intense, comes in waves, and is deeply visceral. Lasting from 4 to 8 hours, the pain is accompanied by a numb sensation at the site of the sting. The ants deliver stings to defend their colonies from large predators, including lizards, birds, and people. Smaller enemies, such as other insects and spiders, are bitten. A person who eats 1,000 ants would probably die. According to Schmidt's book, one ant is enough to kill a mouse. But some predators have defenses. The regal horned lizard has a mucus lining its mouth and digestive system that allows it to eat hundreds of ants and a substance in its blood that neutralizes the venom. Some birds somehow avoid getting stung too. It's hard to get more information on how the ants were used in rituals and the nature of the experience. Disease and violence that came with Westerners during California's gold rush destroyed the indigenous communities in the Central Valley and their way of life. And again, this profile is of the California harvester ant. Its habitat is southwestern United States and northern Mexico. Next, we have Salima, or Sarpa salpa. Its habitat are the temperate and tropical ocean waters, from the Atlantic coast of Africa to the Mediterranean Sea. Fishes including this species of sea bream, as well as some sea chubs and clownfish, can cause auditory and visual hallucinations when eaten, though reports are rare. Sarpa salpa was known as the dream fish in ancient Rome, according to a 2018 review of Psychedelic Fauna, published in Frontiers in Psychiatry. Two cases of hallucinatory fish poisoning were documented in 2006 in the journal Clinical Toxicology. In one case, a 40-year-old man ate baked Salma sarpa and later experienced hallucinations of screaming animals and giant arthropods surrounding his car. The symptoms went away with medical attention 36 hours after he ate the fish. Researchers don't know what compounds cause this ichthyoalaenotoxism, or fish poisoning, which can include nightmares. Evolutionary biologist Leo Smith of the University of Kansas in Lawrence, who studies fish history and diversification, says he and other scientists suspect that the compounds are a byproduct of the fish's diets. But this kind of fish poisoning is distinct from two other forms of fish poisoning. Symbiotic bacteria within pufferfish produce tetrodotoxin, or TTX, that can cause paralysis and death. And ciguatera fish poisoning comes from eating fish contaminated with a neurotoxin produced by some dinoflagellates. It can cause diarrhea, vomiting, and weakness, as well as a reverse sensory disruption, where hot things seem cold and vice versa. But it does not cause hallucinations, says Sondrik Leong, a biological oceanographer at the National University of Singapore. How and why many of these neurotoxins are produced is still being worked out. There are so many relationships with the marine environment, which we are not very sure of, Leong says. And our fifth and final mind bender is the pitted sponge, and its habitat is the Caribbean. The pitted sponge and some other sponges contain 5-bromo-DMT and 5,6-dibromo-DMT. Not all of them, but some of them, including Smenospongia aura and Smenospongia echina. Because of their relationship with the psychedelic drug DMT, these compounds are plausible psychedelics. American chemist Alexander Shulgin, famous for his research into psychedelic compounds and for introducing the world to the synthetic hallucinogen, MDMA, or ecstasy, and his wife Anne Shulgin, wrote in THKAL, The Continuation, that they don't know whether the sponge compounds are activated by smoking or not. They are, however, quantitatively reduced to DMT by stirring under hydrogen in methanol, in the presence of palladium on charcoal. The pitted sponge is known to concentrate in its tissue chemicals called monoamines that can modify the behavior of nerve cells. Not only can these compounds make the sponge taste bitter, but they can also alter the behavior of predatory fish that dine on the sponge. They wouldn't prevent the fish from ever trying to take a bite, but it would prevent it from persisting or consuming the sponge any beyond an initial several bites, says Mark Hammond, a pharmacologist from the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. V. rigida's ability to alter animal behavior intrigued Hammond, who reported in a 2008 study in the Journal of Natural Products that 5,6-dibromo-DMT acted like an antidepressant in rats, while 5-bromo-DMT acted like a sedative. Hammond says that related compounds may one day be isolated and might make for promising antidepressants, anxiety-reducing drugs, or pain relievers in people. And this article, These Animals Can Bend the Mind, is featured in the May 6th, May 20, 2023 issue of Science News.
And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.